This is At Your Cervix, the podcast where pelvic health physiotherapists Emma Brockwell and Gráinne Donnelly talk to incredible guests who help lift the lid and bust the myth on all things pelvic health.
At Your Cervix, the podcast is proud to be sponsored by Pelvic Relief. Founded by Eleanor Gardner, Pelvic Relief strives to offer quality products and information to help manage conditions such as pelvic pain, incontinence and painful sex. Informed by science and quality, they offer best-in-class products for pelvic health. Find out more by visiting www.pelvicrelief.co.uk and access 10% off using discount code ATYOURCERVIX10. Thank you for supporting At Your Cervix, the podcast.
Hi, I'm Helen, and Emma and Gráinne have very kindly let me sneak onto their podcast to tell you about mine. It's called Why Mums Don't Jump, and it's grown out of my own experience of pelvic organ prolapse. It's about pelvic floor problems after childbirth, prolapse, incontinence, pelvic pain, all the things that happen to so many women and that no one ever talks about. Join me to hear women's stories and expert voices as we try to bust some of the taboos around lumps and leaks. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts or online at whymumsdontjump.com.
Hello, everyone. We're delighted to be back doing our At Your Cervix, the podcast sessions. And today we have a really special guest on board. Kirsty Dougal is actually a Scot living in England, in the lovely Cotswolds of all places, very beautiful, somewhere I want to go and visit. But she has a really, really amazing journey to share with us today. Before we get into it, Kirsty, I want to get you to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you before we get stuck in.
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much for having me along. I'm really, really pleased to be here. So I think, as you said, I'm originally from Scotland. I'm now living and working in England due to kind of career push. And I am someone who works in the research funding environment. So I've in the past been a biological sciences researcher myself, and I've stepped over into funding now. I currently manage a small team where we work looking at supporting international research around biosciences. And that's really interesting, really exciting. Outside of work, I'm very, very passionate on horses. Spend a lot of my life riding and being involved. I've been in the horse industry in the past, sort of teaching qualifications and things too. So that's the flip side of me. In terms of why I'm here, I've had a very interesting, difficult journey linked to perimenopause and menopause over the last 4 years. I'm 42 now, so this has been quite early. And there's a huge amount of experience that I think is good to share with people and be open about and just try and really help support other people that might be struggling.
Amazing. I hadn't mentioned this, Kirsty, before we came on live, but I am also, I'm 43. Oh, so I'm actually older than you. Only a few weeks ago was I 43. And I am also going through the perimenopause, probably, goodness, about 18 months, 2 years ago. So I'm really excited to have this talk and, you know, hear your story, because it's really important that we're getting this information to women, because I don't know about you, but I don't think there's still enough information for women or enough education around this topic at all. But perhaps we can begin with where your story began, if that's all right.
Yeah, sure. And I think just picking up on what you said as well, it's, as a younger woman, it's not something that I think is on your radar. And certainly for me, I was not prepared. I had no clue. I was cruising along. In my head, it was something that might happen when I hit my 50s. Yes. And, you know, I thought, oh, women get hot. That's what happens then. No clue that I should be even thinking that way, you know, in my late 30s, because I was 38 when things kicked off. Mm-hmm. And for me, the first sign of things going wrong was suddenly getting really horrendous cyclical migraine. So it was as if literally someone turned a switch on from 1 month to the next, and every 4 weeks without fail, a massive migraine linked to my period that was basically kind of in a dark room, not able to stand up for 3 days. And then another 10 days to get back up to kind of a level of functionality. And this was rinse repeat every 4 weeks.
Oh God.
So, you know, it took about 18 months before anybody mentioned the word perimenopause. because again, it's not maybe one of the typical symptoms. It's not something that people instantly associate with perimenopause, especially at the age.
Who mentioned it to you? Who actually flagged it?
It was a neurologist.
Oh, wow.
I went through lots of discussions with GPs, didn't really get anywhere, had to try numerous migraine preventative meds, which didn't help because hormone-driven migraine is very resistant to most drugs. They were pretty horrendous in their own right, lots of side effects, and then eventually managed to get a referral to a neurologist. And at that point, the first thing he said is, have you thought about perimenopause? So I had actually been considering there might be something else going on myself because there was a few little kind of changes in my cycle. Nothing massive, but I'd always been really regular and everything was just consistent and things just started being a little bit different. So I didn't think perimenopause, but I thought something's not quite right with the hormones.
And had you been someone that tracked their cycle prior to this, or because you'd been so regular, not really given your menstrual cycle much thought?
Yeah, exactly that. Because it was just such a regular thing for me. I didn't, you know, other than, you know, being aware of when things were happening for a clashing with, you know, important things going on in your life and that side of it. But no.
Yeah. I think that's one of the big things that we're certainly trying to promote more now on. We've just written a course called The Athletic Female. And we're really trying to encourage girls and women as soon as they start their periods, really, to track their periods. And I certainly think I'm seeing across the board, healthcare professionals, medical professionals are really encouraging that to happen now, because it is so imperative that we're using our period as a strong health indicator for when something's wrong. What is it that Michelle Lyon said, Gráinne, when we had her on the podcast about the menstrual cycle?
It's the fifth vital sign, isn't it? That she talks about it being another vital sign in our body, which I think she's right, because we think of all the traditional ways that we think of our vital accordance, and I think it's really, really relevant. If anyone hasn't listened to that, that was the final episode of season one, and it's a cracker in terms of getting insight into menstrual health and then this transition into menopause. And on that topic, Kirsty, when we were, I suppose, connecting initially, we don't really know the ins and outs of your story, and that's why we're so excited to learn about it today. But one of the things you did mention was that you entered a forced or chemical menopause versus the traditional transition into menopause. What's the difference? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, of course. And I think there's quite a lot of different things, and I've been through most of them, so probably a good person to give you some experiences. So one of the things that happened with me after seeing neurologists is we started experimenting with HRT as a way to try and resolve migraines. That worked to a certain extent, but I was still having issues. The next stage was to be referred to a gynecologist who suggested we went through a chemical menopause, which effectively they give you a drug. They're called GnRH agonists. And what they do is they switch off your ovaries. So by using a drug, we stop your ovaries producing all your natural hormones. So effectively it puts you into that kind of drug-induced menopause. So it was a bit of a test, kind of see what would happen if we did that, whether the migraines would resolve and what happened with my body. So that is a temporary thing. That's not a permanent thing. So I came out of that again. And then since then, I've actually had surgery to remove my womb and my ovaries. So I'm now in surgical menopause. So both are a bit different to natural menopause.
And so you had your hysterectomy how long ago now?
That was just August, so just past 6 months.
Oh my goodness. And how did you feel? So you would have been 41 making that decision?
Yes.
Is that right? I mean, how did you feel making that sort of decision at such a young age?
It's a really interesting one, because I think I wasn't making a decision from a place of being in a healthy state. So my life was so badly impacted by everything I was facing that I didn't feel I had a choice.
Right.
Because I told you about the migraine that I was facing, but things kicked off and were a lot worse by the time we agreed for surgery. And after I recovered from the chemical menopause, it was quite clear that I was suffering really severe menopausal, perimenopausal symptoms at the same time. So, you know, I went through 6 weeks where I was having really bad hot flushes every hour, night and day. It was about Easter last year, you know, so sleep deprived, couldn't function, just could not function, signed off work, considering kind of long-term sick. So, you know, it wasn't an option.
Wow. And what other symptoms were you struggling with, or have you been made aware of that other women are struggling with because of the perimenopause?
Yeah, so there's a massive list of symptoms that are related. And for me, what's been really interesting is they're not always obvious. And I think there's a huge number of people that wouldn't connect the dots. If I'd been better informed, I might have made better connections. So I have a list next to me that's like a symptom checker from actually, I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Louise Newson. Yeah, so she's a really big advocate for menopause education and health. And I can't speak highly enough about what she does. So that the list, you've got heart palpitations, feeling nervous and tense, sleeping problems, memory problems, anxiety and panic attacks, difficulty concentrating, fatigue, loss of interest in life, being unhappy or being depressed, crying spells, irritability, feeling dizzy, faint, pressure or tightness in your head, tinnitus, headaches and migraine, muscle and joint pains, pins and needles in different parts of the body, breathing difficulties, hot flushes, and then you get cold flushes as well. They are great fun. Night sweats, loss of interest in sort of sex and low libido, and then you get urinary symptoms and kind of vaginal symptoms as well. It's a massive list.
It's a massive list, and the majority of those are not, as you say, typically associated by both the general public and, as you've learned, by medical professionals in terms of perimenopause or that transition. People often nearly almost belittle the transition to be something, a few hot flushes and your period stop, and it's as if it's that simple. Whereas we know that transition actually has a significant impact on the quality of life of the majority of women who go through it. And you mentioned how it was eventually the neurologist who mentioned about perimenopause and perhaps that link of hormonal migraines. Now, just considering the journey that you had been on to reach that point, and I suppose for a moment thinking, imagine that neurologist had not picked up on that. Did you feel that you were lost in this healthcare system going around about and getting no answers?
Oh my goodness, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was at my total breaking point. You know, I mean, I remember having a conversation with my GP before I got the referral to neurology, and sort of just, you know, I couldn't live like this. You know, I just could not keep going like this. And I also spoke to, you know, about that there were some things with my cycle changing, and I thought there was a hormonal link. And I got given the kind of response of, well, I can either refer you to a neurologist to sort migraines, or I can refer you to a gynae to talk about hormones. There's just no holistic support within our medical system at the moment. So I think if you've got anything that's a bit different and a bit difficult, so perimenopause plus migraine, two conditions that are really poorly understood, you know, it's, I don't know what I would have done. I'll be honest, I think, if I hadn't managed to get that.
There's almost an element of, you nearly probably think, are you not, you obviously know you're not imagining the symptoms, but when you're going to healthcare provider after healthcare provider and they don't seem to understand or be aware of these symptoms as being something that's quite commonly experienced, it must actually feel like you're nearly going insane.
Oh, yeah, completely. And I think for me, like, I mean, I come from a scientific background, you know, I read primary literature, I can find information, and I can find things for myself. I couldn't get anywhere, and I knew there was a problem, and I couldn't do anything. And it really made me think, what the hell happens with somebody who doesn't have that to tap into as well? You know, and the other side of it as well is I've been able to benefit from private healthcare. Because through my employer, we get a company called Benenden coverage. So if the NHS wait times are beyond about 4 weeks, they can step in and escalate. So I only had to wait like 2 weeks for my consultant appointment from a neurologist, and then for loads of downstream stuff. I could have still been spinning in the system now, and even for another 2 or 3 years.
I think so many women are. I mean, I'll touch on my experience if that's all right, just to compare notes really. When I felt I was possibly going through the perimenopause, in truth I thought I was actually going mad. My biggest two symptoms were brain fog and quite severe anxiety. Actually, I had four big symptoms because I also had really severe breast tenderness, like I've never experienced before, and awful night sweats. And it all correlated for me at a time when work was really busy, the pandemic, life's busy, I have two young children, and I just thought, you know what, there's two things going on here. Either I'm burning out or I've got early onset dementia, you know, because I like to think worst case scenario. And I just, even as a pelvic health physio, I didn't kind of join the dots, which I kind of find is a little bit bonkers given what I do. Because if you'd come into my clinic, my first thoughts would have been, hormones, maybe perimenopause, but don't always relate the two when it's yourself. And I, like you, I just was at my, you know, my wit's end with it. So went to my GP and I was kindly given a leaflet with some advice on how to get some online CBT. And I thought, I know this is more than, it's more than my mental health. It's more than that. Because you know your body, you know that something's more than that. But it really took me quite a few appointments to even touch on the subject. And even then, I think I would have been 40, bordering 41. I've lost track of time and dates. It's probably 41. And I was just told it wasn't possible. I was too young to just go away and get some therapy. And then, of course, the great Louise Newson, thankfully, was on the scene. And I, like you, just really lucky to have private health cover and tap into the Newson Clinic. And at that point, I knew, and they fortunately confirmed my suspicions, which was a relief hugely. But there's also that frustration of, oh, come on, why aren't we, you know, educating women more on this? But also, why aren't we as medical professionals or healthcare professionals flagging it sooner? And I guess for you, because you were that bit younger than me, it wasn't on their radar, which is just madness when you think really the perimenopause can start from the age of 35. It can unfortunately start younger than that as well. I mean, given all of that and given where Louise Newson has taken this topic, do you think women are getting more education and quicker reactions to their symptoms as a result of all the work that she's done?
I think that's a really hard thing for me to sort of answer as an individual, because I think I can only talk to my own experience and where I find things. But that said, I am on quite a number of sort of support groups on Facebook, you know, following the hysterectomy and also helping to juggle the HRT and things like that. So I see quite a lot of discussion that's going on with other women, and it still does seem that there's a lot of people come to some of these pages totally clueless, you know, and the questions that are being asked are really basic ones. And you can see the pattern again and again, like your story, like mine, where you know from that first question, oh my God, yeah, this is what's going on. So I don't know that it is. You hear a lot of people speaking about not managing to get any traction with their GP and having nobody in the practice that's a specialist. And just being palmed off and thrown antidepressants. So I think the problem is massive still. And it's a postcode lottery as well for specialist menopause services. So I know that where I live, I'm in Gloucestershire, I was told by my GP, there is not a menopause specialist through the NHS in our area. So I ended up going privately through Newson as well, because I'd had enough messing around. And fortunately, was in a position where I could afford to do that myself. I know that's not the same as a lot of other women, but it's really challenging.
Yeah, it really is. I know Louise has set up the Menno charity now, which I believe is set out to fund at least one GP in every GP clinic to become a specialist in the menopause. But that's going to take time to educate everyone, and especially given the load that the GPs are under and have been under through COVID, that's it's just another thing to add to their incredibly long lists. But what a valuable thing it will be when every woman has at least one specialist that they can access. That specialist is going to be very busy. That's all I can say.
What I'm interested in is, obviously the right management for you was the surgical line that you ended up pursuing. But like anyone, especially from your background of being quite informed and au fait with the scientific literature, did you attempt or dabble with any of the natural methods of trying to manage perimenopause?
No, I didn't. I think because my symptoms were so severe, and I think I've got to recognise here that I have been on the extreme end of this. Like, it's not what I've been through isn't the kind of normal average experience that everyone has. And unfortunately, when I went straight into trying HRT, so it turned out I'm severely progesterone intolerant. So that's another problem. And I react really badly to my own hormone fluctuations. So there was other pieces to the jigsaw for me, which sent it down that way. But I absolutely have to use HRT. I would not be on my feet without having estrogen to supplement what's going on.
So what were the signs that you were progesterone intolerant, Kirsty?
Yeah, so, and again, when you start HRT, you have to have both estrogen and progesterone. So the progesterone protects your womb and stops sort of overgrowth and potential cancerous cells. So you can't have estrogen on its own. Although it's the estrogen that you need to resolve the symptoms, you know, that's what's causing all the menopausal symptoms. So when I had the progesterone component, and at my age, because you're still having cycles, you only have it for so many days a month. When I was on it, I was getting horrendous side effects. So really horrendous mood. I mean, very dark thinking to that extent. Headaches, nausea, just feeling like I was a zombie. I wasn't in my own body. For some women, they love progesterone. It helps them sleep. For me, I'm wired and up all night. And just, yeah, I mean, pretty horrendous. And then I was getting rebound migraine as well, like really severe migraine one of the days I stopped it. So, it pretty obvious that I wasn't able to tolerate. We tried a few options as well, because with some of the body identical progesterone that you can get now, it's micronized progesterone, it's tablet you take orally. It can also be used vaginally and absorbed that way so that you bypass the liver and reduce a lot of the side effects. So it didn't matter how I took it, it was still a really strong side effect.
Yeah, I had similar, not sorry, I didn't have similar side effects, but I had side effects to progesterone. Really minor compared to yours, but severe bloating. I don't know if it helped my sleep really at all, because I feel like I'm always tired, so I can't comment on that. But I just felt very uncomfortable on it. And so rather than taking it orally, I was also advised that I could insert it vaginally as well, which has actually made for me quite a difference. But that's the as we've already touched on, just how bespoke each and every woman's, you know, intake of HRT is. It really has to be by a specialist that you're advised about this. And that's why the generalist needs to become the specialist in that GP setting. Here's one thing I'd love to know though, how are you finding getting hold of HRT at the moment? So the estrogen, for example.
Yeah, so I'm okay. I am aware that there are problems just now. I think particularly with one of the gels with estrogel, there's some supply problems. But I've had issues settling onto HRT because I'm really hormone sensitive and the gel just doesn't suit me at all. So I'm using patches, and I'm on a very, very high dose of patches because I'm young and had surgery. But so far, touch wood, I'm getting it. I think I might cry and fall apart if I can't get it, because I'll be signed off work. There's no two ways about it.
Oh my goodness. So it's really, it's fundamental to your everyday functioning, this estrogen.
Yeah, if estrogen is low for me, I'm almost having to take to my bed.
And how supportive have work been? Like, you know, because this is something that I think from a workplace point of view is often not given the recognition that it needs.
Yeah, so I think, again, I feel really, really fortunate to work for an organisation that generally the culture is great. And we have a really generous allowance for sick leave. So that's been absolutely fine. However, as time's gone on, because I've been off a lot over the last few years, I've hit their kind of sickness trigger points. And I ended up having to have like a formal absence meeting at the end of the year, which was handled in the same way as like a disciplinary. Not because of the people, don't get me wrong, they were lovely, but all the documentation, all the policies, all that kind of thing, you hit into that pathway and suddenly it's all this really scary formal language and consequences. And so it's, and it's a big organization I work for. I mean, you're looking, what, 7,000 or 8,000 people work for it. So it's quite startling. They don't have a menopause policy. And it's also public service, so that makes it even even worse. But on the positive side, they are looking at this, and I'm putting my head up there as someone who's willing to be involved and be part of the change.
Excellent. So that's going to help so many people. I know it wasn't in place for you when you needed it, but there's something quite nice and empowering about being the change, to ensure that other women are safeguarded in this regard. I'm also interested in, obviously you've had such an extreme response to the hormone fluctuations and the transition. When you look back now, like, is there any, I suppose, genetic predisposition? Is there any family sort of history of having really poor transitions?
I think, I don't know a huge amount. I've got quite a small immediate family. But I know there is often like genetic kind of links. And I know my mum was kind of younger as well. So, you know, that ties in.
In terms of education around the menopause, there's two sides to this I want to look at, really. Have your work looked into having talks on the menopause for your work community so that men and women are becoming more aware of signs and symptoms of the menopause and how they best manage that within the workplace?
So there's some very early conversations going on at the moment, and I think that's where they're heading to. But I mean, I'm not in the driving seat per se, so it's, I will keep offering up the suggestions of what would make good, but that I think is a really key part to it, is just normalizing things. And for me, younger women, you know, just having a bit of a clue and a bit of a heads up so that as they hit their mid-30s, they're kind of going, oh, something's changed, maybe I should start tracking, maybe I should start keeping an eye on things.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is a conversation Gráinne and I have a lot, that, you know, really this should all be starting way down in the, you know, the grassroots at schools, so that girls are aware of these transitions that they're going to go through life, rather than finding out about them when they're in the thick of them. And that's one of the key things I think needs to change in education around, you know, sex education and everything is what's going on for a woman's body. So it'd be nice to see that happening more, really, wouldn't it?
One of the things I'm laughing at is that I think it's really important that for even the, I suppose, the teenage boys to be hitting this information time and time again so that they have more understanding and awareness of this. But actually, one of the people who connected Kirsty with us regarding your story was someone who's actually got several needs to be honored several times in relation to our podcast, because Rob Bevan is a chiropractor who you were under the care of, and you can tell us how this came about from him in a second, but he also had input into the name of our podcast.
He named it.
Yeah. we ran with it. He suggested it, we ran with it.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
I knew you were going to say that.
I go to Rob regularly because I've got an old shoulder injury, an old fracture that needs bits and bobs doing to it. So you know, he's been aware of what's been going on medically because of the migraine side of it. So he just happened one day when we were having a treatment to sort of say, oh, by the way, I know these lovely guys and they do this amazing podcast, and what do you think, would you be interested, would you mind me introducing you? So yeah, of course, absolutely.
But we need more Robs, then, do you know what I mean? Because someone who's comfortable even discussing female related symptoms and transitions like this, because a lot of guys shy away from it, or, you know, find that it's not something they could talk about, and yet it should be more normalized, and that's part of getting males on board too. So well done, Rob.
Absolutely well done, Rob. Kirsty, you're 6 months post-hysterectomy now. I'm obsessed with postnatal. That's all I ever say. Post and natal, that's all that ever comes to my mind. But you're 6 months post-op now. How are you doing, first of all?
Yeah, I mean, I think physically I'm doing really well. I find the kind of the surgical side of it and the physical recovery an awful lot easier than I expected it to be. which is great. The hormone side is difficult. I'm still having really big ups and downs getting things settled, because I think it takes a while when you have your ovaries removed, because your own body stores and levels fall away over time. And as you start HRT, any hormonal change, it has to bed in, and then you have to increase a dose, and then you have to settle. So you can't just kind of flick a switch and have everything where it needs to be. Mm-hmm. So I've actually just had a really big blip over the last couple of weeks with needing more estrogen again. So I think I'll get there, but I'm not quite there yet. I've spent a lot of the last 6 months not going far from home because I've just not had the energy, and, you know, feeling pretty crap a lot of the time, to be honest. So, I can see hope going forward. So, and the really, really amazing bit is I haven't had a single migraine since my surgery. Okay. So that's just staggering, considering I've had 4 years of having them, you know, every 4 weeks, sometimes more. Brilliant.
Okay, what a difference that must make.
Yeah.
Out of interest, before they got to the nitty gritty of your migraines being part of perimenopause, were you getting scans and things in terms of like, were they looking into your migraines in terms of other pathologies and things?
Nothing.
Huh?
Not a thing. I had to keep going fighting. The first thing I was offered was to try a coil, which I didn't want to, but felt I didn't have an option, and I did, and it was horrific. Had to have it removed as an emergency about 5 days later because my body just went, I don't think so.
I bet it did.
you know, and then it was just this repeat conversation of me going, I can't do this, I can't cope, I need help. Well, we could maybe think about this, you know. And my GP's lovely, so I feel really bad. You know, she's I've got a youngest GP who's really sweet. And now that we're where we are, she's been amazing at handling the HRT side of things. And she's totally happy to follow the direction of specialists, things that are off license as well.
That's great.
At that point, it was really hard.
Yeah, it's a real struggle, isn't it? And how has your, so obviously hormonally things aren't there yet. What about the rehabilitation that you were offered post-hysterectomy? Were you offered any form of pelvic health physiotherapy? Does that even mean anything to you when I say that? So what happened in that sense?
So I got a little bit, but that's because I was fortunate enough to go private. Again, through Benenden, when I was told I would have the surgery, they stepped in. So I only waited 3 months to have surgery, which could have been 2 years, I think, if I'd been on NHS. And as part of that package through private hospital, you have a discussion with a female physio that works in women's health before surgery. And then they come and see you on the ward the next day, you know, before you leave. And then I had a follow up with them, I think, about 6 weeks later. So
fantastic.
Oh, I love that.
The dream.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know I've been fortunate. I know a lot of the other people aren't. And I see on some of the support groups, people are discharged, basically booted out the door after their operation and told nothing, not even wound care follow-up.
You know, it's funny because you know, possibly in perspective to the 4 years of torment and symptoms you had, you found the actual physical surgery probably okay afterwards. A lot of women, I think, underestimate just how much of a major surgery hysterectomy is, because it's something that lots of women have, and it almost becomes as routine as I think childbirth has become considered. But yet it is a major abdominal or vaginal surgery, and we have to bring awareness of that because the body does take time to recover afterwards. Would you be aware of that even from the support groups that you're involved in? Would you think that there's many women who realize afterwards that that was actually a bigger thing than they maybe anticipated?
Oh, 100%. There's a huge, like, a lot of discussion about, oh, how long will it take before I recover? You know, and it seems the advice from professionals is really variable as well. And it's quite frightening, actually. You get some that are having maybe just a hysterectomy rather than ovaries as well, and it's being done, you know, laparoscopically, and they're being told they'll be fine in 2 weeks.
Oh, stop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no, seriously. And it's, you just think, geez, you know, that's just not, it's not right. It's not fair. Yeah, so I think there's that lack of understanding. I think with a physical recovery, most people are informed and they're fine with that. The bit that a lot of people struggle with, I think, is the hormonal side if you have ovaries removed, And I do see quite a lot of people have that are struggling and are, oh my God, I wish I'd never done this. Because I think many women, it's more of a, I wouldn't say totally elective surgery, but it's more, they've had really bad periods and they've had maybe some endometriosis. And yes, it's been horrendous, but they've not been given the information to weigh up that actually what you're moving to might not be better.
Yeah,
you're trading one set of issues for another set of issues.
Yeah, it's almost sometimes sold as quite a simple fix, like this is a simple solution when there's a lot more complexities to consider. Just when I'm thinking of it, and we'll pop it into the show notes afterwards, but for anyone who's listened to this, who's either maybe planning or considering following gynecological surgery like this, the POGP have some really useful free to download resources. So they have a resource book on recovery after gynecological surgery, and it's just really, it's nice even to start reading that now, just so that you can see what the time frame and timeline's like and what things you might have to consider, because anyone doing this also needs to consider what's going on in their life at that time in terms of how long they might need to be off work, if they have children or grandchildren, what they need to factor in terms of recovery, and because they'll not be lifting anything heavy for the first 6 to 12 weeks, you know, it'll be really progressive loading. But yeah, we'll pop that in, because as you say, it can often feel like there's no guidance out there. And you want to make sure that the guidance you do access is evidence informed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think also really important to remember that it is important as well to do pelvic floor exercises after having this type of surgery, so as to protect and improve your pelvic health as you get older. So I do think it's really important that anyone undergoing this type of surgery does see a pelvic health physio. And as you say, Kirsty, you're really lucky that you had that. But I see lots and lots of women, as you say, who just don't get anything beyond their follow-up with their consultant and then discharged, because that part of their journey with the consultant is over with. So if you have had any type of surgery like Kirsty's had, do speak to your GP, even if it was 5 years ago, do speak to your GP about seeing a pelvic health physio, because it's important to address that side of your health for certain. Kirsty, where are you at now with life? So have you gone back to horse riding? Have you ridden your horses since having the surgery?
Yeah, so this is a difficult one, because I went from a place, let's say 4 years ago, where, you know, I had a horse of my own. I'd be riding 5 days a week, 6 days a week, competing, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it was really part of my life. In the last 2 years, that's been zero, because I've just not been physically well enough. You know, to be able to do it. And I think when you're struggling as well, you end up focusing on the essentials, which you've got to work, you've got to, you know, kind of support yourself. So that comes above everything else.
Yeah.
So I actually managed, I've been on twice, once in, I think, November, a couple times in November, actually, when I was feeling physically recovered from the surgery. But then unfortunately the hormones fell apart and I've had to just back away. But I can see it. I can see the positivity, and I can see I'm going to be able to, and I have grand plans of buying another horse and getting up and running, but I think it'll be a slow climb because physically I'm in a mess, fitness wise.
It will happen.
It will. And look, at anything, no matter where you have surgery or where you've required a period of rehabilitation for, there's deconditioning that happens naturally. And I think it's really sensible that you already know that there's going to be a period of getting that fitness for that activity that you're looking to get back to built up again. I think this has been such a fantastic discussion. I think it's really raising awareness to things we've touched on already. And as you say, it's nearly the repetition that's setting in with me, that women time and time again are finding it very difficult to get the help that they need for this process that all women are going to go through at some stage. So we need to be doing better, and we need to be making sure that more health professionals are aware of the signs and symptoms. We need to empower women so that they're aware of the signs and symptoms, so they can keep going back and doing a bit of pushback. Because as you say, you're informed. Equally, Emma, you're informed. And you're two people who are showcasing examples of having a little bit of a difficult or a few hurdles to jump before you can access the care you need. And ultimately, you needed to bypass and go private. We need to do better so that women are accessing the care they need within the generic and public health services that are available. I suppose what, Kirsty, if you could leave one key message for anyone listening to this, what, whether the health professional, whether the general public, is there any key message you can think that you want to leave or finish on?
Yeah, sure. And I think it's different messages for the two different groups, actually. And I think I would put a plea to the medical professionals that, you know, if you're not up to date with your CPD, if you're not a specialist in this area, please don't pretend you are. You know, be willing to be honest and say you don't know and refer people on, or go and do a course yourself, find out the courses that Louise Newson's running. For women, I would say if there's something not right, trust yourself. Don't be palmed off. If your doctor shuts you down, that goes against the guidance that they have. There's meant to be shared decision making now. So they shouldn't be doing that. There are online sources that are really good to go and get information and point you in the direction so that you can be your own advocate. Unfortunately, now you have to be your own advocate. There's no getting away from it. And I would say Louise Newson's website is an amazing one. There's also another good one, which I don't know if you've come across, which is called Menopausal Not Mad. A lady called Jane Pangborn, who went through this kind of episode and has now created a service. And again, there's good evidence-based information and signposting. You know, and there's some good Facebook groups as well. So I think that's go and find out more, know what's going on, and know what you can and can't say to your doctor to help get the help that you need.
Absolutely. We'll put all of those in the show notes, and we'll also put the NICE guidance that was released in 2020. And that really clearly defines what you're entitled to and can, you know, you can work with your GP to help get the right treatment for you. So they're great to have hold of as well. Kirsty, thank you so much for sharing a really incredible personal story. It will mean a lot to so many women, and I'm sure could be quite life-changing for someone listening. So a million thank yous for sharing such a personal journey.
You're so welcome. And you know, I think anybody who goes through this kind of thing, it just becomes really important to try and make sure other people don't have the same challenges. So yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. We really hope you enjoyed it. We always love to hear your feedback and any questions you might have. So please do contact us via Instagram at @yourcervix_thepodcast or Twitter at @yourcervix_PM. And don't forget to check out our wonderful sponsor, Pelvic Relief. You can find them at www.pelvicrelief.co.uk. Gráinne and I really look forward to catching up with you next week.